Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the update on the CARDINAL trial for bardoxolone and Alport syndrome. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. A PDF version of the presentation is available now on the webcast and the Reata website at reatapharma.com in the Investor News section, where an audio recording of today's webcast will be available shortly after the call today. Before the company proceeds with its remarks, please note the forward-looking statement disclosure in the company's press release. The company will be making forward-looking statements on today's call. There are many factors that could cause results to differ from expectations, including those noted in the company's SEC filings. Today's statements are not guarantees of future outcomes. Please also note that any comments made on today's call speak only as of today, July 24, 2017, and may no longer be accurate at the time of any webcast replay or transcript rereading. Following the prepared remarks, we will open up the call for questions. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up so that we can accommodate as many questions as possible. I would now like to turn the call over to Vinny Jindal, Vice President of Strategy.
Thanks, Latoya. Good morning and welcome to Reata's conference call to review the results of the Phase 2 portion of CARDINAL, a Phase 2-3 trial for bardoxolone, methyl, and Alport syndrome. I'm joined today by Reata's CEO, Warren Huff, and our Chief Medical Officer, Colin Meyer. I'll now turn the call over to Warren.
Thanks, Vinny, and thanks to all of you on this call for joining us today. Reata initiated a development program in a severe form of chronic kidney disease called Alport syndrome earlier this year. We did this for several reasons. First, bardoxolone has consistently and dramatically improved kidney function as measured by estimated glomerular filtration rate, or eGFR, in every human clinical trial and setting it has been tested in, including our prior clinical trials in CKD caused by type 2 diabetes. Second, our development partner, Kiowa Hako Kirin, recently completed a technically difficult clinical study in which bardoxolone's effects on kidney function were measured using the gold standard inulin clearance method to directly measure rather than estimate GFR. Their study conclusively demonstrated to the nephrology community and others that the historical unprecedented improvements in estimated GFR in the presence of bardoxolone are indeed reflective of real improvements in kidney function. Third and most important, the United States Food and Drug Administration provided us with a path to approval in Alport syndrome patients using a retained estimated GFR-based endpoint in a single study. With that backdrop, earlier this year, we launched a Phase 2 trial in Alport syndrome called CARDINAL. We started by enrolling 30 patients in the Phase 2 portion of the trial, and we measured those patients' change in estimated GFR over a 12-week period. We were hoping to observe clinically meaningful improvements in estimated GFR that confirmed that the GFR improvements observed in our other clinical trials of bardoxolone would be replicated in Alport syndrome patients. I'm pleased to announce today that the Phase 2 portion of the trial has exceeded our expectations, and we are initiating screening and enrollment of the pivotal Phase 3 portion of the CARDINAL study. I'll now turn it over to Colin to provide a brief background on Alport syndrome and to review the Phase 2 data from CARDINAL.
Thanks, Warren. Alport syndrome is caused by mutations in type 4 collagen, an important component of the filtration barrier within the kidney. These mutations cause the barrier to be leaky, resulting in excess filtration of proteins, which initiate inflammatory and fibrotic processes. This cascade promotes loss of kidney function, which ultimately leads to end-stage renal disease and the need for dialysis or a kidney transplant in most patients. These pathogenic processes and the rate of loss of kidney function are similar to type 2 diabetic CKD, where Reata has generated a substantial amount of data for bardoxolone, making Alport syndrome a compelling indication for us to study. In addition, there are no therapies approved for Alport syndrome, with most patients taking off-label ACE inhibitors or ARBs, which have a modest effect on delaying time to ESRD. Data from the literature suggests that these patients progress on average 1 to 4 mL per minute each year. The phase two portion of Cardinal was an open-label trial enrolling 30 patients with a genetically confirmed diagnosis of Alport syndrome with a broad age range and range of kidney function. Patients were titrated to either 20 milligrams or 30 milligrams orally once daily and were dosed for 12 weeks. The week 12 change in eGFR was used for determining whether to proceed into phase three. Improvements of less than 3 mil per minute would have made it clear that the Alport syndrome disease is distinct from diabetic CKD, and we would have been unlikely to proceed forward since it would have taken a large number of patients to demonstrate the treatment effect. An improvement of between 3 and 5.5 mL per minute would be a clear demonstration of activity, and we would have increased the sample size to achieve statistical significance in the pivotal phase three. An increase of 5.5 mL per minute or higher would enable us to move forward with our existing protocol for the phase three. The improvements in eGFR, as shown on slide five, were greater than our original expectations. 30 patients were enrolled and none have discontinued. 7 have not had their week one assessment, and the top row of this table details how many patients have reached the indicated time points. From a baseline eGFR of 54.7 mL per minute, evidence of kidney function improvements were noted as early as week one, and they increased in a time-dependent manner to a very large overall increase by week 12. Over 80% of patients demonstrated a clear clinical response of greater than 3 mL per minute by week 8. Because of the large magnitude and consistency of the changes, the p-values are very low at all time points. By week 12, the mean improvement was 12.7 mL per minute, with a confidence interval of 7.9 to 17.5 mL per minute. This increase equates to recovery of a few to several years' worth of progression. Notably, the lower bound of this confidence interval is roughly 50% greater than the on-treatment effect we estimate will be needed at 48 weeks for the pivotal study to be successful. The figure on slide six shows a comparison of the Cardinal data to the eGFR data from the BEAM and BEACON diabetic CKD trials. Our modeling assumptions for the phase three of Cardinal were based in part on the results of BEAM, a study of bardoxolone in 227 patients with type 2 diabetes and CKD, presenting with a range of eGFRs that were overall lower than, but overlapping with those in Cardinal. As expected, mean eGFR improvements in Cardinal were overall slightly higher than and largely overlapping with the improvements observed in BEAM. Regarding the safety results for Cardinal, bardoxolone was well tolerated, causing no discontinuations and no serious adverse events. As observed in previous trials, bardoxolone produced muscle spasms that were generally mild to moderate in intensity and were not associated with markers of muscle injury. Only a few additional adverse events were reported in at least 2 patients, and no others were reported in 3 or more patients. The Data Monitoring Committee reviewed all available safety data and voted to recommend opening the phase 3 portion of Cardinal. We announced earlier this morning that screening in the phase 3 portion of Cardinal is underway, and based on the results of the phase 2, we'll enroll 150 patients rather than the 180 patients we originally anticipated. This change is due to the better than expected variability, intrapatient eGFR correlations, and magnitude of the treatment effect. The phase three will be a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, randomizing patients evenly at up to 100 centers worldwide. The primary endpoint of the trial is the on-treatment change in eGFR relative to placebo at 48 weeks. And the key secondary endpoint, which is the basis for accelerated approval, is the retained eGFR benefit relative to placebo after a 4-week withdrawal period at week 52. Patients will be restarted on study drug and treated for an additional year to measure on-treatment effect at week 100 and the retained eGFR at week 104. The retained eGFR benefit relative to placebo at week 104 is the basis for full approval, with no post-marketing commitments currently required by the FDA. Drawing upon our prior on-treatment and withdrawal data from trials in diabetic CKD, which enrolled approximately 2,600 patients, we were able to conduct a highly informed analysis for powering the phase 3 CARDINAL trial. Previous studies have demonstrated a highly significant correlation between week 12 changes in eGFR and 1 year on treatment, as well as retained eGFR changes. These studies suggest that the retained eGFR benefit in CARDINAL will be approximately 40% of the eGFR improvement at week 12. As the table indicates, if the phase 3 portion replicates the eGFR improvement seen in the phase 2 portion of CARDINAL, it would produce a mean retained benefit at week 52 of 5.1 mL per minute, with the bottom end of the confidence interval exceeding the 2.2 mL per minute difference that would be statistically significant for the phase 3. Examining this analysis in more detail, in BEAM, an improvement of 12 mL per minute translated to a retained benefit of 4.7 mL per minute, or roughly 40%. This result was statistically significant with 90 patients. Looking at the last row of the table, the minimum difference to reach statistical significance for a phase 3 trial enrolling 150 patients is 2.2 mL per minute, which equates to a week 12 on-treatment effect of 5.5 mL per minute. This contrasts favorably to the 12.7 mL per minute observed in the phase 2 portion of CARDINAL, which is more than double the minimum on-treatment effect that we estimate will be needed for the phase 3 trial to be successful. It is worth noting that this assumption includes no change for the placebo patients who decline at least 1 mL per minute annually. In summary, bardoxolone has the potential to be the first approved treatment for Alport syndrome, has the potential to delay or prevent end-stage renal disease and the need for dialysis or kidney transplant for these patients. As a once-daily oral capsule capable of achieving response rates exceeding 80%, we are encouraged that bardoxolone has the potential to become the standard of care in this chronic, life-shortening orphan disease. I'll now turn it over to Warren for discussion of the future development of bardoxolone in CKD.
Thanks, Colin. As we were assessing Alport syndrome as an indication for bardoxolone, more than one nephrology key opinion leader mentioned that Alport was among the most intractable forms of CKD and that positive results in this disease would suggest that bardoxolone could have a meaningful impact on other rare renal diseases where the same underlying processes of inflammation, remodeling, and fibrosis play key roles in the progression of their kidney disease. While we're working to launch the pivotal phase 3 portion of CARDINAL, we'll be carefully considering the optimal development path for expanding bardoxolone's commercial potential in CKD. We expect to launch phase 2 trials in more than one of the rare diseases listed here in the first half of 2018. I look forward to updating you on our progress and plans in the renal space in the coming months. With that, we'd be happy to take questions.
Latoya, would you mind opening the line of questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star then one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. We do have a question from Adam Walsh of Stifel. Your line is open.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Warren, Colin, and Vinny, thanks for taking my question. Terrific data this morning. Congratulations on that. My first question is regarding adverse events. Colin, you had walked through some of those, and I'm specifically wondering whether or not there was any indication whatsoever of fluid retention in any of these patients in this particular study. That's question number one. Thanks.
Hi, Adam. Yeah, thanks for your question. And so there was no indication of any beacon-like safety finding. One important reason why we had decided to study our drug in Alport syndrome is that the patients look very different than those patients in the beacon trial who had stage 4 CKD, a history of heart failure, and were inactive heart failure who developed the event. BNP is a very important marker, you know, of the fluid status of those patients. 100 is the upper limit of normal. 300 is the limit for diagnosing heart failure. And in the BEACON trial, the patients who developed the safety finding had baseline values on average of 550 picograms per mil. Importantly, there was no increased risk in patients who had values below 200. In the CARDINAL trial, which enrolled Alport syndrome patients, these patients do not have any disease-related cardiovascular comorbidities, and those patients are actively excluded from the trial. We're not enrolling stage 4 patients. And importantly, the maximum BNP that's allowed in the trial is 200. When we look at the 30 patients who enrolled in the phase 2 portion of Cardinal, the average BNP was just over 20, so approximately one-fifth of the upper limit of normal for a healthy person. The maximum value was 84, still well within the normal limits. And so these patients, you know, are very distinct from the Beacon patients who developed a safety finding, and you know, we would not expect to see what we saw in the Beacon trial. Furthermore, the Data Monitoring Committee, which is independent to the company, has been overseeing the safety of the trial, and they reviewed all available data and recommended opening the phase 3 portion of Cardinal.
That's terrific. And then, Warren, I know we had talked recently. As you know, we've talked to a lot of key opinion leaders in the space about the potential for bardoxolone in other chronic kidney disease indications, and several of them that we had spoken to had mentioned Fabry disease. You have a long list on the slide presentation that you put forward today. When we talked recently, you had also mentioned type 1 diabetic CKD, and with all of the different potential indications to move forward can you kind of elaborate a little bit on your thought process on where you think the most relevant disease states would be to bring bardoxolone forward in next? Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to, and thanks for the question. A key point here is that because of the pharmacology of bardoxolone, you know, directly down-regulates inflammatory processes, it intervenes really below the inflammatory stimulus. So whether the, you know, inflammatory trigger is caused by their autoimmune disease or a genetic mutation or their underlying diabetes, the downstream pathways that cause the chronic fibrosis and remodeling of the kidney are really common across these many types of CKD. And so that's the mechanistic reason that we think the drug, you know, could be active across a range of diseases. And, of course, now we've seen activity in both CKD caused by type 2 diabetes as well as CKD in Alport syndrome. In terms of how to determine which one of the best things about this space is that in a relatively short, very tractable clinical trial like the phase 2 study here in Alport syndrome, we can quickly get a read on whether we can produce significant improvements in renal function, you know, in the patients simply by putting them on drug for 12 weeks. So for us, and then we would have, if we see responses like we've seen in Alport syndrome, we'd have high confidence to advance the program to a registration study. So I think our plan will be to triage these, but to simply do a series of phase 2 studies and see if the drug works.
That's terrific. Congrats on the great data, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. The next question is from Charles Duncan of Piper Jaffray. Your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my questions, and let me add my congratulations for very nice data so far in Alport. Question regarding the phase 3 program. First of all, nice to see fewer patients needed to demonstrate clear clinical utility. But I guess I'm wondering about timelines. Could you provide any guesstimates on the time to enrollment? And then the two-year follow-up, is that driven by efficacy or is it driven by safety? And is there any chance for any interim type information to come out of that program beyond enrollment?
Hey, Chad, it's Colin. So thanks for your comments. And so to start with your question about the timeline, and so I'd like to point out that we enrolled 30 patients, you know, in the phase 2 portion of the trial across, you know, 11 clinical centers in 4.5 months. And so, you know, we're always conservative in our estimates. We're increasing the number of sites to up to 100 for the phase 3 portion of the trial. And as we've stated today in the press release, screening is already underway for the phase 3 trial. And so we estimate that we'll have data by the second half of 19 for the one-year endpoint. But obviously, you know, it could be sooner based upon enrollment rates, and we'll provide more guidance in the future.
With respect to your comment about the in about the 2 years. This was the request of the FDA. Was they stated specifically that the retained EGFR benefit at week 52 after 1 year could potentially support accelerated approval if it's statistically separated from placebo, and to come back, bring that data back to them. They ask us that, you know, while we're having our NDA interactions with them, to just go ahead and put the patients back on their original treatment assignments and then let them continue for the second year, essentially to get the second year of data, you know, while the NDA was being processed.
Okay, that's helpful. And then regarding, you know, markers of clinical benefit, in addition to estimated GFR, you know, are there any other markers that you were tracking that you believe support clinical meaningfulness? And is, you know, EGFR something that patients know? Is this something they track in terms of the progress of their disease? I mean, how do they see this marker?
Yeah, Charles, and so I think a few comments. So first of all, patients absolutely know their EGFR. And so it's what's tracked at every single visit. And obviously once patients, you know, lose, you know, a lot, they end up needing a renal transplant or to be on dialysis for the rest of their life. And so it's extremely important to the patients, and it's known amongst the patient community. As far as other, you know, markers of benefit, within the trial, of course, we were measuring several different parameters. And, you know, as we've shown in diabetic CKD, you know, changes in EGFR correlate with markers of filtrates within the kidney, so BUN, uric acid, phosphorus. And so we have not commented on that data, but we'd expect, you know, a similar change in those parameters. And once again, we know that this does reflect a true change in kidney function, and that's extremely important to the nephrology community, that we've now shown with our partner that the drug does in fact increase measured GFR. And as far as the clinical meaningfulness, you know, we think the, you know, on-treatment effect is the full renal benefit of the drug. Importantly, FDA wants us to show the off-treatment retained benefit, which would be evidence of disease-modifying activity. It also rules out harm. And so that's why we're measuring those two endpoints. The primary endpoint at week 48 is the on-treatment effect, and the key secondary is the retained benefit. And we'll, have, of course, have those data from the phase 3 trial by the second half of 19.
And then finally, with these 30 patients, could we anticipate additional presentations of data, and might you be able to point to where that might be or and when?
Yes, I think as we state in the press release, we'll have final week 12 data for the 30 patients by the end of the year.
Okay, good deal. Thanks. Congrats. Nice work.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Matt Kaplan of Ladenburg. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I guess let me add my congrats to the top-line data that you added announced today. Looks very good. I guess first, can you comment on kind of the natural course of the disease in terms of Alport syndrome with respect to the rate of decline in kidney function? And then also relate that to what you're seeing in the phase 2 and what you're modeling in the phase 3?
So sure, Matt. And so the natural course inevitably leads to the need for dialysis or end-stage renal disease in most patients. And so Alport syndrome is caused, as you know, by mutations in type 4 collagen. The most severe form is X-linked or autosomal recessive, and those patients are typically diagnosed usually around age 8 when they're in for a physical. There's blood in the urine that's detected. Patients are worked up and are found to have Alport syndrome. And in those patients, the median age at time of end-stage renal disease is 25 years old. And so, you know, quite young. Females who have X-linked disease, importantly, aren't just carriers. They also do develop loss of renal function, and about a third of the patients are on dialysis by the time that they're in their early to mid-60s. And so when you look across the literature at the natural history studies that have been done, the annual rate of decline is about 1 to 4 mil per minute, depending upon a few factors, including the genetics. And so in our trial, we enroll patients across the EGFR range from 30 to 90, across the proteinuria spectrum, and across the age range. And so we have a good, we think, representative population in the phase two part of the trial. And so when you look at the change of 12.7 mil per minute by week 12, represents several years worth of progression. The drug is frankly recovering kidney function in these patients.
Yeah, and a key point that needs to be appreciated on the estimated GFR measurements, and again, because of Kieran's work, we've now really conclusively demonstrated that those estimated GFR improvements are real renal function improvements. And if your GFR is going up, obviously it's not going down. And if it's not going down, you're not going on dialysis. And patients are very aware. They kind of watch their GFRs count down, and they know that when those GFRs decline below 20 and get around 15, that, they're going to be on dialysis or need a transplant.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And then in terms of, you mentioned the dose titration during the study in terms of going to 20 or 30 milligrams per day. I guess, can you help us understand in terms of number of patients that made it to 30, and was there any sort of a dose response that you saw?
And so we haven't commented on the specifics of the titration, except to say that it's very flexible, and almost all patients have gotten to their goal dose that's based upon their proteinuria status at baseline. While our drug is primarily metabolized by the liver, it's highly protein-bound. And so if patients are spilling a lot of protein into their urine, they need a higher dose to reach similar exposures. And so that's why the goal dose is different for the patients who have macroalbuminuria. And so obviously it's been working well because we've had zero discontinuations thus far.
Great. Thanks for taking my questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Ritu Burrell of Cowen & Company. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the questions. I wanted to ask about background treatment for these patients and what you might expect in the phase three. I think you mentioned that ACEs and ARBs are gold standard for these patients right now. Were all patients on background? And what are your expectations for background treatment in the phase three?
That's a great question, Ritu. And so, yes, and so the standard of care for these patients is off-label use of blood pressure agents, including ACE inhibitors and ARBs. And so in the phase two portion of the trial, 90% of patients were on them. Occasionally it's contraindicated. Two of the patients who were not on it had normal levels of proteinuria, and so it was not clinically indicated. For the phase three portion of the trial, we have an eligibility criterion that mandates that patients be on the maximum tolerated labeled dose of an ACE inhibitor or an ARB unless it's clinically contraindicated. And so we would expect it to be probably similar to what we observed in phase two. And importantly, patients will be required to be on the current standard of care. So we're adding bardoxolone on top of that in the phase three portion of the trial, like we've done in the phase two.
Okay, and so that that figures into your placebo assumption of 1 to 4, 1 to 4 point annual decreases in the power of the study.
We actually didn't even include the placebo decline in our estimate, so it's an aspect of the conservative powering. Obviously, in the clinical trial setting, patients are watched very carefully, and so what you typically see in clinical trials is a much smaller placebo effect than what you'd see outside of a clinical trial. And just to be conservative and reduce the risk of failure, we were not assuming any placebo decline, even though we're sure that there will be some.
Okay. And then is there any pre-specified stratification that you're planning for the phase three portion, either by disease type or anything else?
Yes. And so the primary stratification factor is the amount of proteinuria, because that associates with rate of progression on a population basis. And so there are three individual strata, and so up to 300 milligrams per gram in the first morning void of their for albumin creatinine ratio, 300 to a gram, and a gram to 3.5 grams.
Got it. And last question, did you, across the variability, which I understand is lower than you were expecting, did you see any either super responders or was there any commonality between the non-responders that you saw in this population so far?
I would say that the data are kind of consistent with what we've seen before in diabetic CKD, where you know at least 80% of patients you know showed frank improvements, and that's more than sufficient for the you know powering of the phase 3 trial. As of now, there's you know nothing obvious, but there may be once the number of patients increases.
I just add one point too. It's important to remember how we define responder. You know, in most trials of CKD, the attempt of the intervention is to simply prevent the decline, you know, in GFR. Here, you know, we're actually producing a frank improvement in GFR from baseline, and we set that threshold at, you know, 3 mL/min. So you know, when we say 80%, that's patients that actually had frank recovery and an increase in GFR. It may be that there's a higher percentage of patients that don't decline over time.
Got it. Thanks for taking all the questions, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Yigal Nochomovich of Citigroup. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the question. Hi, how are you?
Great.
Yeah, good. On the correlation between age and EGFR, so you were enrolled between ages 12 and 60. I'm just curious if you saw any, you know, concentrated benefits in the younger patients potentially.
No, and so we did enroll across the age range, but we saw, I think, activity across the entire age and EGFR and proteinuria range. And so it's not like the drug is only working in a specific subset of the patients. We saw broad activity.
Okay. Are you planning to look at this retained EGFR benefit in the current 30 patients, or is that only for the phase 3?
The patients, we haven't decided. These patients are continue on drug past the 12 weeks.
Okay, so that's still an open question if we could see retained
yep.
benefit sooner?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Importantly, the phase 2 portion is you know, open label, I mean, there's no placebo, and
yep.
it's not powered to show that. The phase 3 portion of the trial,
yep.
Which is placebo controlled,
yep.
and 150 patients, is powered to show the off-treatment effect.
Okay. And given this data, are you guys going to apply for breakthrough for Alport?
It would certainly appear to meet all those, you know, all the requirements for that to us.
Okay. Got it. Can you just comment briefly on the, you know, how you triangulate to the 12,000 patients in the United States, 40,000 worldwide? Is that based on, you know, a calculation of based on incidence to get to a prevalence number? Are you looking at registry data or the literature? Just can you just elaborate on how you get those numbers?
Yeah, those are just, you know, basically available, you know, published data. This is an interesting area because, you know, it's a genetic disease where you can make a clear diagnosis, but since there's no approved therapy, there really is not been a significant amount, you know, of commercial work, you know, done around these patients. And so we would expect that there would be kind of at least that number of patients.
Okay, thanks. And then just going back to the data finally, so you had 80% with at least a 3 mil per minute benefit. Did everyone in the trial benefit in any positive way, or did anybody actually decline on EGFR, or no?
Yeah, I mean, it's 80-90+% you know, had some improvement, and we would not expect any declines in this, you know, duration of treatment.
Yeah.
So once again, this is
okay.
kind of beyond our expectations
yeah.
for, you know, this very
yeah.
severe intractable disease, and so once again, the phase 3 now reduced the sample size by 30 patients because of the magnitude of the treatment effect, the interpatient correlations, and the variability parameters. To us, the data look great.
Yeah, it looks very much like what we observed, you know, in the stage 3 diabetic CKD patients.
Great. Okay. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the star then 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. We have another question. The next question is from Brian Scorney of Robert W. Baird. Your line is open.
Good morning. This is actually Nina on for Brian. So regarding proteinuria, how do you think about that as a marker of renal damage and a potential benefit from treatment in contrast to measuring eGFR?
So it's a good question. And so most compounds that are in development use proteinuria as an endpoint. Because they do not affect eGFR or kidney function. You know, we have the only drug that frankly improves kidney function, and so proteinuria to us is much less important. Importantly, in Alport syndrome and many other forms of CKD, proteinuria is simply a marker of injury and structural damage to the kidney. In the setting of Alport syndrome, protein leaks into the urine because the filtration barrier is leaky because of the mutations in type 4 collagen. And so we would not anticipate that our drug would, of course, correct those mutations and therefore lower proteinuria. And so that's why eGFR, of course, is the most important, renal marker because it is the function that then defines, when, how they're progressing and when they need dialysis or a kidney transplant.
I just add, too, that it's the actual endocytosis of the protein in the proximal tubules is one of the main drivers of the chronic inflammation, fibrosis, and remodeling in the renal interstitium. And we actually... the key secondary endpoint of the study is we put the patients, on drug or placebo for 48 weeks, and then we remove the drug for 4 weeks, and we know that there's no active drug or metabolites present, and then we compare the estimated GFR back to both baseline and placebo. And in our two longer-term diabetic CKD studies, we showed unequivocally that after patients had been on for a year and then they were taken off drug, their kidney, their estimated GFR, which we now know is real GFR, was significantly higher than their baseline value, leading strongly to the conclusion that there's been a structural improvement, in the kidney. And I think that would trump any secondary marker like protein status.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. And once again, if you do have a question, please press the star then 1 key on your touchtone telephone. And I do show we have a question from Bert Hetzelt of BTH. Your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the question, and congratulations on the results. Could you, you addressed this a little bit earlier, but I'd love to come back to it. How do you think about the prioritization of other indications beyond Alport? Thank you very much.
Yeah, so hi, this is Colin. And so we've been assessing, obviously, the indications listed on slide 12, as well as others. And the first factor is the relevance of our pharmacology to the pathogenesis of the disease. And we and some of our close academic collaborators think that inflammation plays a fundamental role in progression of many forms of CKD. And so when you look at this list, IgA nephropathy is basically an autoimmune disease that causes inflammation and then loss of kidney function. And so we've observed activity in patients with autoimmune disease with bardoxolone, and that's the basis for our ongoing phase 3 trial in patients who have connective tissue disease-associated PAH, so basically lupus and scleroderma patients. Fabry disease, once again, to us, it's similar to Alport syndrome. It's caused by a genetic mutation that our drug cannot fix, but those mutations then result in downstream inflammation and fibrotic processes that are relevant to the pharmacology of our drug. And then type 1 diabetic CKD obviously is very similar mechanistically to type 2 diabetic CKD, and inflammation plays an important role. polycystic kidney disease. You know, it may seem very different. There are mutations that cause formations of cysts. By inducing NRF2, our drug suppresses NF-kappa-B. NF-kappa-B has been shown to be important at cyst formation. Furthermore, there's inflammation that's induced in regions of the kidney that are not cystic because of the ongoing inflammatory reactions in the adjacent parts of the kidney. FSGS has excess spilling of proteinuria, which is excessively absorbed and induces inflammatory reactions. And so all these are relevant from a biological perspective. There are other things on the list as well. And so the other key factors that we're considering are, number one, cost and time to test. And so, can we rapidly, enroll for and efficiently determine if there's activity, like we've done in Alport syndrome? And then lastly, the regulatory environment, which is why we've been focusing on rare diseases in our portfolio. And so we were given a very tractable endpoint for Alport syndrome, and we would want to make sure that there's a good likelihood that we'd have a similar or the same endpoint for these additional indications.
Thank you for the additional color. Congratulations again on the data.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you. And there are no further questions in the queue. I'd like to turn the call back over to Vinnie Gendel for closing remarks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening into the call and for the thoughtful questions. We're looking forward to updating everyone as we make progress. Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, a downloadable PDF of today's presentation and audio recording will be available shortly after this conference call on Reata's website at reatapharma.com in the Investor News section shortly after the call today. This does conclude the call. You may now disconnect. Good day, everyone.